And welcome to another episode of Things That Make You Go Book Review Podcast. Thank you again for joining me. I'm sorry I've been MIA for a couple months here. As those of you who are listeners know that I work as a public school teacher, and we have had summer break here in the United States for the last couple months. And like most things about all these podcasts I was going to do and all these great books I was going to read and how I was going to bring it all to you. And like most things that people do when they are on vacation and they hope to get things done, I got just about none of it done. So that's my fairly weak excuse. I hope you can forgive me. And I do have a book for you this week. So why don't we go ahead and get to some books? So the book that I'm going to be reviewing is called Strangers in Their Own Land by Arlie Rothschild. And I'm actually going to be reviewing this book with another book that I read called Deer Hunting with Jesus. And both books basically have the same idea. And that is, I'm aware that here in my country, the United States, we have elected in November easily the most controversial, most mind-boggling, perplexing person to be our leader of our country, which is Donald Trump, a former television star, reality television, and real estate investor. And I, like most people, I became very curious as to what made this guy so appealing. Why did people decide that they wanted to take a chance on somebody with no political experience, had never run for any office before, and all of a sudden now decided that they wanted him to lead the most powerful nation, wealthiest nation in the world? I couldn't really understand it. And apparently I'm not the only one who had trouble with this, because a number of social psychologists have went out and wanted to study the issue. So I also became interested in this and I wanted to read the book. So what the author, what she decided to do was she decided to do a social psychology experiment where she would travel to different parts of Donald Trump's most loyal voting supporters, which were in Louisiana, Texas, a few other places where Trump won by huge margins, and basically just interview the people and try to get a sense of what their stories were, what they were thinking, how they came to their own conclusions, so on and so forth. And I was pretty surprised. I mean, I've reviewed other books that you can, I believe I have podcasts for, such as The Republican Brain and Conservatives Without Conscience, where the authors talk about how basically the brain structure of Republicans might just be anatomically different than that of somebody who is a liberal. But I don't know to what extent I fully believe that. But the author, whether it's, you know, cultural upbringing or whether it's anatomical, I do think that the results are mostly the same. And that's when the author wanted to just figure out what the stories were of these people. I mean, are these people unintelligent? Are they just foolish? I mean, what is the reason that they voted for Donald Trump? Were there any merits to what their thinking was? And what the author came to find out was that there's a deep psychology in the, I guess, in the more conservative areas of the country, that the government is an aggressive, hostile entity that is mostly concerned with helping people who are immigrants and who are minorities and have all but turned their backs on the white working class. And the Republicans, and especially some of these newer Tea Party members, newer people, you know, like Donald Trump, they've really kind of embraced the white working class. I mean, some people would say that it's a form of demagoguery, and all of these promises that were being made really don't add up to anything. And you'd have to be foolish to believe that industries such as coal and other sort of manufacturing bases that the United States has lost to other countries that can produce the products at a cheaper price. You know, well, in the case of coal, you know, we now have started doing hydraulic fracturing, known as fracking, and importing shell oil from Canada. So coal is just being outcompeted. We found cheaper, cleaner alternatives. But it doesn't necessarily mean that people have given up on the idea that they can once they can return back to their old lifestyle. And I do know that Donald Trump, in a lot of ways, some of the biggest places he won, such as Kentucky and West Virginia, are huge coal producing places, huge coal producing states. And so the government is seen as an entity that comes in and takes money, okay, and takes your resources. And they're an aggressive form of controlling, you know, their lives. So to somebody who has been watching television or not, and you've seen the rise of movements such as, say, the Black Lives Matter movement, which is protesting lots of different things, but mostly unequal treatment and aggressiveness by police officers, you can see that it's been a tremendous rallying point for liberals, people who are identify as Democrats, but it's also been a big rallying cry and unifier for Republicans as well, that this is exactly what they're talking about, that Black lives matter. It's not all lives matter. When, for example, when Bernie Sanders was at a rally and they asked him, you know, what he thought of Black Lives Matter, and he says, yeah, I support him. I think all lives matter. And he took a lot of criticism for that. And so these conservatives would say, well, this is a perfect example of the government, the people, the media, the liberal culture, basically trying to extinguish us, extinguish our values, extinguish our way of life. And we need some sort of force that's fighting on our behalf. So, what the author noticed that there were definitely certain trends among people who were staunch Trump / conservative voters. They tended to be older and white. No surprise. Mostly because a lot of these people, they can remember growing up in the 1950s, in the 1960s, when America was, even the 1970s to some extent, was doing well economically. And we weren't quite in the throes of such a, embattled globalistic economy, I guess you could say. And so the United States had a very strong manufacturing base and agriculture base and all of these things. And I guess these people are just saying, what happened? How did we lose all of this? At what point did we decide that we wanted to help people from other nations more than we wanted to help our own people? Another thing that the author noted is she calls it the three pillars of conservatism, and that is faith, taxes, and honor. Now, of course, faith being, I would say probably 99% of these people are most likely evangelical Christians. And so, you know, in the Christian theology, there's a very strong emphasis on, you know, being loyal and being faithful and believing in Jesus. And, you know, I've reviewed many books that talk a lot about tribalism and this whole idea of you got to be careful when you belong to a team, because anybody who's not on your team can be perceived as being an enemy. And so, you know, these people, very often, that's what they think. They think that, well, the liberals are pushing for gay marriage. They want, you know, in schools, they want to teach kids about gay sex and, you know, these other things, which, you know, I would consider to be fairly ridiculous. But I can understand that, you know, if your religion says this is evil and then all of a sudden the government is saying, you know, this is perfectly acceptable, you're going to have to reconcile some differences that might be difficult. So that's one aspect. Is the concept of faith. And then, of course, I was talking earlier about taxes and this concept of the government takes your money from you and doesn't really give you anything in return. And I don't really know exactly how they come to that conclusion. I know that the states in the South tend to be the more economically disadvantaged states. They tend to be the biggest recipients of Social Security and Medicare and welfare and Medicaid and all those other things. So I don't know what the appeal of trying to roll back these government programs would be, but still, I mean, this is a huge problem. The whole concept of welfare. I And what welfare basically means is that the government will give you a small amount of money each month and some basic services like healthcare and some job training and a few other things, basically just to keep people from being out on the streets and starving to death. I mean, this is almost exclusively aimed at single mothers. And it's just, it's so little money. It's like, you know, $12,000 or $13,000 a year. Certainly not enough to live on, but maybe it'll keep a family from starving to death. But there's this whole idea that people have become dependent on this government program to the point of they have no initiative to want to go out and work and make a living for themselves. There might be some merit to this, I suppose. I guess there are always going to be a certain segment of the population that are going to try to abuse government programs. But speaking as somebody who has family members with mental illness who have been on state disability for for many years now, I know that they are unable, they have always been unable to make a living for themselves. Certainly our wages, the minimum wage is so low, it's impossible to make a living for yourself by working full time if that's what your wages are. So there's just no way that they would have any chance of having any kind of a survivable life with dignity unless there were these government programs. So that's where I'm coming from. And I think it's important that you know this, that I don't really agree with what these people are saying, but that doesn't mean that I can't understand, and the same with the author was saying, that I can't try to figure out what their point of view is. Now, I don't know what the end game for all of this is. I don't know if it's going to be possible for the two sides to reconcile their beliefs. I don't know if compromise is really an issue. I mean, people talk. I mean, I don't really know what the value is of understanding somebody else's point of view. Other than just being interested in trying to show some empathy, because, I mean, let's take the issue of abortion, highly controversial. If you truly believe in your core that abortion is murder, that it's killing, okay, you cannot just like compromise. You can't say, okay, well, yeah, even though it's killing, we'll let women do it up to the first trimester, or yeah, I guess if a woman was, you know, possibly raped or there was incest or whatever, the woman's health is in danger, well, then maybe it would be okay in those circumstances. I mean, no, you can't. You can't compromise. Murder is murder, period. End of story. Okay. So that's why I feel as if it trying to come up with any sort of compromise very often is going to be almost impossible. Now, the last tier of the three tiers is the concept of honor. And honor being that you support people who are like you, that you understand that you have to defend your way of life against an encroaching threat. The encroaching threat might be minorities. It might be gay people. It might be immigrants. All of these groups are routinely paraded and attacked by conservatives. And I think what people most fear is they fear that their own way of life is dissolving into something else that they don't support. That there's a bit of a, you know, the abortions and the immigrants and the liberal culture is committing a sort of genocide on them. And they're worried about this. They believe they're fighting for their very life, their very survival. I can remember when I read a post on, I forget what it was talking about. Oh, yeah. I think there was some issue in California where they did some study and they were saying that if we stopped allowing immigrants to come in and work in the farm fields in California, then food prices would go up by like, 40, 50%. And I remember somebody made a post on Facebook saying, you know, let's just thank these immigrants because they're doing the jobs that nobody else wants to do. And then there was another person who made a reply to that and said, when I was growing up, we worked in the summers. We picked cherries and we picked other fruits and we used the money that we made to buy school clothes for ourselves. And I think that's just such a beautiful message. I mean, I don't know to what extent what he was saying was true. I mean, I don't know if that's like a model that could be applied to everybody or if that's even possible. But it's such a beautiful concept. You're young, you go out, you work hard, you make a little bit of money, you spend that little bit of money on things that can benefit you to make your life better in the future. And I can understand why that's important. I can understand why we... I don't know. It's hard to say. I think that sometimes stories are so much more powerful on our psyche than any sort of data. And I know this to be a fact because when people very often will, you know, two people will debate a subject, one person will inevitably almost always bring up a story about someone they knew, someone they saw. And that person's story defies what you're saying, and therefore it also invalidates your argument. And, you know, I mean, that's just not the way things work. There's always going to be a contradictory story to something. I think that's why general statistics are so much more important, but not everybody really wants to process those. Not everybody wants to think about them. I don't really know exactly what the author was able to figure out in terms of how people are going to deal with the situation when the economic situation continues to deteriorate. Are they going to continue to support the same sorts of people? I think that's one of the most fascinating things about Donald Trump is, yes, he did identify himself with a Republican, but he was so much more radically different than anybody else that I think people felt like they were kind of getting the best of both worlds. They were voting for somebody that was similar and different at the same time. They got somebody that looked like them, identified with them as the same party, the same religion, the same value system, but they weren't part of the establishment. And that was just so attractive to people. Me personally, I think that, I mean, I'm going a little bit off the rails here, forgive me, but I do tend to do that on my podcasts. I think as long as we have corporate and moneyed interests who are funding our politicians, I just don't think it'll be possible to ever really get somebody in office who has the public's best interests in mind. I really encourage you to read the book Republic Lost by Lawrence Lessig. It really, really changed my mind about, I mean, I knew campaign financing and corporate donations, I knew those were important, but after reading the book, I just realized that it, until you get the money element out of politics, it really doesn't matter. I mean, if you really nail down Democrats and Republicans down to the nitty gritty, their ideas about Wall Street, their ideas about the military industrial complex, their ideas about taxing the wealthy, they're pretty similar for the most part. Maybe there's some small differences. They're different on social issues. But I think the social issues have really masked the problem of the economic disparities that are happening. I think about people like, for example, in one of our states in our country, Kansas, we have this governor who actually left to take a low-level position, I think, with the Trump administration, named Sam Brownback. And he really put into play all of these ideas that the Republicans have been championing for a long time. Cut taxes on the wealthy people, reduce spending on government programs, then all of that free income will go to people and then they'll use that money to invest in private businesses and you'll have a flourishing state. I guess it sort of sounds like it makes sense. But after doing this, the state is facing major financial losses, major financial problems. And what did they do? How did they reward Sam Brownback for these failed policies? They reelected him. So I don't know. I don't know what it's going to take for the political revolution to happen. Maybe the political revolution is already happening. But anyway, after reading this book, I definitely feel like I got a better sense of what the deep conservative thinker who is religious, who's honor-bound, who is skeptical of the government, I understand a little bit more now what the appeal of Donald Trump is. I understand now what it's going to take to try to win some of these people over. I don't know if it's going to be worth it to do. We'll see what happens in the future. There's a lot of them. They're strong. They're loyal. And I don't know. The world is, our country is definitely in a state of political disequilibrium, and we'll see how all of this shakes out. Okay, well, that's about all for me for now. Thank you again. I am sorry that I haven't been with you for a few months now, but I will try to get myself back on schedule now that I'm back to work again. Until then, thank you for joining me and staying all the way to the end of the episode, and happy reading.